Let's turn to Acts chapter 14. Starting in verse 8. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled. Ooh, is that loud? They'll turn it down. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled in his feet, who was lame from birth and never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him, saw that he had faith to be healed, and called up, "Stand up on your feet." At that, the man jumped up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lyconian language, "The gods have come down to us in human form." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermes because he was the chief speaker. I imagine Barnabas liked that because Zeus was the chief god. And it made Paul look like he was like one of his little cronies. So Barnabas thought that was probably cool. The priests of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought bulls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to them. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed out into the crowd shouting, "Men, why are you doing this? We too are only men, human like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. In the past, He let all nations go their own way. Yet He has not left Himself without testimony." The American Standard Version says, "He has not left Himself without witness. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy." Even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowds from sacrificing to them. Now, what Paul was doing there is what we're doing. He was providing evidence to a group of non-believers about the existence of God. Now, he did it real briefly, and he just kind of said two or three things real fast. But that's, if you look closely, that's exactly what he did. He did not say, "Oh, no, you need to believe the Old Testament," did he? Didn't bring up the resurrection. Why? That's not where they were. They were a bunch of people who believed in heathen gods. And so he addressed the God issue. As we talked about last week, you're going to run across more and more people now who that's what they believe. Okay? And so you need to be prepared, and you may never say anything more to anyone more than what Paul said. You may just say something that small. But that is what you need to tell people depending on where they are. Okay? And that's why we're talking about evidences. Now, before we go on, I just want everyone to know we have a celebrity in our midst. In the late 1970s, it could have been in the early 80s, a young teenage girl in Los Angeles, California, ruined Madeline Murray O'Hare's day. And that young teenage girl was none other than our own Kat Watson. Let's give her a big round of applause. She was working at a television station? Yeah. Television station. And her one job was to put Madeline Murray O'Hare in one room and a Catholic priest in the other. She's 19, couldn't quite grasp that concept, put them in the same room. And ruined Madeline. Isn't that awesome? I just thought that is one of the funniest stories I've ever heard. So good for you, Cat Watson. Way to go. Power to the people. There you go. So if you want details on that, just talk to her later. It's a pretty funny story. Let's kind of review quickly what we talked about, just a couple things. Number one, I want you to remember what evidence is. Evidence is anything that is taken as a reason or ground for believing a statement to be true or false. We talked about that last week. It's a very important concept. We want to give evidence for what we believe as to where we are with a person. If a person does not believe in God, then we want to give them evidence for God. If they believe in God but don't believe in the inspiration of the Bible, we don't need to give them evidence for God. We need to give them evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. If they believe in God, believe in the inspiration of the Bible, but they are not sure about the deity of Jesus, you would think, well, how in the world can you believe in the inspiration of the Bible and not believe in the deity of Jesus? A lot of people will believe that. There's a big argument now in the religious world about Jesus calling Himself the Son of God, or did Jesus always refer to Himself as the Son of Man? Big discussion going on about that right now. It's kind of been on the news a little bit in some public areas. So, wherever people are, we need to give them evidence to show where a statement is true or false. Another one I want us to look at is the relationship between faith, sight, and knowledge. I just kind of want to reiterate this so we'll just remember it. Faith is opposed to what? Sight. We walk by faith and not by sight. Sight means empirical evidence, things we can see, touch, taste, feel. We don't live by what we see, touch, taste, feel, do we? We live by our faith. Faith is not opposed to knowledge. Faith is based on knowledge. Knowledge of the existence of God, knowledge of the inspiration of the Bible, knowledge that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Okay, that's what our faith is based on. Say, well, does that matter so much? Yes, it does. Because a lot of times we get into touchy-feely about whether God exists, the Bible is His Word, or Jesus is the Son of God. How do I know God exists? I talked to Him this morning. That is... No, don't say that. Don't say that ever again. If you do, I'll find you out. Don't do it. Because you say that, you automatically dismiss yourself as someone who knows what He's talking about. You know God exists because of the evidence. You know the Bible is the Word of God because of the evidence, the same with Jesus being the Son of God. So, faith is not opposed to knowledge. Faith is based on knowledge of these things, but faith is opposed to sight. In fact, if you look in the Bible, the word knowledge is used over 1,200 times. Faith and belief are used half those amount of times. 30 times, about 29 times rather than the New Testament, the phrase, in fact, or translated literally, the fact is used 29 times in the New Testament. Jesus used it 9 times. Jesus 9 times said, well, the fact is, what's that say? Jesus is making a knowledge claim. He's saying, this is the truth. This is absolutely true. And so we don't need to be afraid of that. You don't need to be afraid to say, I know God exists, I know the Bible is the Word of God, and I know Jesus Christ is the Son of God. You're not being arrogant, you're just stating the truth. Are you being arrogant when you say, yes, I know gravity exists? No, that's not arrogance, that's just the truth. Now don't be arrogant about it, but you can still say that. Let's see, we did those. Atheism, because we'll talk about this more towards the end, but right now, I want to remind you what atheism is. It says there's adequate evidence to warrant the conclusion that God does not exist. The atheist says, God does not exist, and I can prove it. If someone tells you they're an atheist, then you need to, after you've been kind and so forth, and gentle, obviously, you need to put it back on them and say, can you give me proof that God does not exist? Most atheists want to say, well, you need to prove to me that God exists. Okay, I'll do that in a minute. First of all, you prove to me that He does not exist. And I think it's time we got a little bit aggressive about that. It's time we said, okay, I will. You show me first. Jesus did that. They came to Jesus. They said, by what authority do you do these things? Jesus said, I'll answer that question if you answer my question. Didn't He? So you can say, I'll answer that question, but you answer my question first. Prove it to me. Okay? Don't be afraid to do that, because atheist says he can. And there's Madeline Murray O'Hara. In fact, this is probably the day that she bet Cat Watson, and she's smiling to not be around her anymore. Agnosticism. Let's talk about some more things this morning. Agnosticism is the belief that there is adequate evidence to warrant the conclusion. There is not adequate evidence to warrant the conclusion that God exists or that God does not exist. Therefore, we suspend judgment on the issue. You ask an agnostic if God exists, they say, "Don't know. I just don't know. I don't know if he does. I don't know if he doesn't. I don't think there's enough evidence to either go either way. I just suspend judgment." Okay, that's an agnostic. Some people call agnostics, I think we talked about this last week, lukewarm atheists. They're neither hot nor cold. They just don't know. A lot of people who claim to be agnostics are actually, or atheists rather, are actually agnostics. When it boils down to it, they really don't have any idea one way or the other. Now, I personally think it's more difficult to talk to an agnostic than it is to an atheist. Because agnostics, they just kind of are very open-ended about everything. They're so open-minded, they're open-ended. They don't want to make a knowledge claim about anything except the fact, the knowledge claim that you can't know anything. We talked about that last week, how ridiculous that concept is. Because you still are making a knowledge claim. So an agnostic is someone who just suspends judgment. They say, "I don't know one way or the other." Academia in America, all over the world, is full of agnostics. All of your children's professors in college, almost everyone's an agnostic or an atheist. Just so you know that. Just be aware of that. And if God is brought up in any class whatsoever, pretty much they will talk to their students from an agnostic/atheist back framework. So that's another good reason to know this stuff. When your kid gets in school, you want to be able to talk to him about it. You know, Matthew, my youngest child, one day, he came to me and he's at Georgia State, and he said he's thinking about changing his major. He said, "You know, I thought about becoming an anthropologist." He said, "But I kind of got the feeling that I have to go to atheism to do that. So I don't think I'm going to do that." I said, "Good decision." You know. Deism. You say, "What in the world is deism?" Now, I just want to share this with you because it's important to know who an important deist was. Deism is the belief that God based the designs and laws found throughout nature. The design presupposes a designer. Deism is therefore is called a natural religion. Deism is not what you are. You're not a deist. Deism says, okay, there's some design out there. I don't think this just all happened. I think there's some design out there. But it's like all the natural stuff, the world and the universe and all that, it was created by a supernatural being, but we don't know who he is. And he really doesn't have anything to do with the world. And that's why I got the picture up here, I don't know if you can see it, of the guy with the clock. Deists basically believe that God created the world, wound it up like a big clock, and then tossed it. And so the world's gradually spinning down, and there's no such thing to the deist as supernatural revelation. Okay? They only believe that there's natural stuff out there that shows there's a God or a designer or a supernatural being, but they don't believe in the Bible. You say, well, why is that important? It's important because the framers of the Constitution, everybody hold on, get your seat ready, were deists. They were not Christians. Thomas Jefferson is the father of deism. Benjamin Franklin was a deist. George Washington was an Episcopalian, and he was pretty religious. He was pretty devout. But about everybody else was a deist. So we as Christians need to be careful and say, oh, well, we have Christian forefathers who started this country. Not really. Okay? Not really. I don't want that to blow anybody's mind, but you really didn't. They were deists, not what we are. So that's very important to remember, because when they talk about the rights of man under God and so forth, they're not talking about it from a biblical perspective. They're talking about it from a supernatural being, but we live in a natural world, not a supernatural world. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. Evolution. Yeah, everybody goes, Okay. Now, let me talk, just give you, before we go talk about evolution, we're just going, and I want to say this at the beginning. Our evidences class is very, what we call, high level. Everybody know what that means? High level means that we're just kind of, you know, understanding some terms and hitting some basic points, and we can't get into a lot of depth just because of the nature of our class. So just so you understand that, I don't want you to think, oh, he's going to give me 15 reasons why evolution is wrong this morning. I'm not going to give you that. I'm going to give you two great questions to ask an evolutionist, which will make them think. So just so you know, the whole class is kind of high level, and hopefully we can have some seminars. I'd like to have a weekend seminar on the existence of God, and we just really get into it. When on the inspiration of the Bible, we really talk about it. I think that'd be good for us. Okay, so this is kind of the evolutionary chart that we saw when we were growing up, right? Except at the beginning, they didn't have the space guy down here on the end. That's been added, which I thought was, why did you put that on there? And we'll talk about Darwin in just a minute. Although Darwin technically didn't say this, there was a monkey, blah, blah. He was a little bit, that's kind of how he's always interpreted it. But technically he really didn't say that, you know, but that's kind of what's been thrown on him. I don't agree with Darwin. Let me just make clear about that. But that's kind of not fair to say that, because he really didn't say that. But this is kind of the evolutionary chart. Evolution is the process of change in all forms of life over generations. The word evolution is not a bad word. Life does change. Things do change. Things do evolve. Okay, so that's not a bad word in and of itself. It's kind of the theory behind it. This is, can everybody see Charles Darwin? Kind of, sort of. Okay. Yeah, Chuck, that's him right there. At a much older Charles Darwin. You might just want to write this down if you want to. Evolutionary biology, and that's the main thing that we hear. That's why I put it up there. We pretty much hear about evolutionary biology. Evolutionary biology is like kind of a sub-theme under biology. But that's the one we hear talked about most of the time. And that is the study of how evolution occurs. Evolution kind of talks about a whole realm of things, you know. But pretty much the one we hear about the most is evolutionary biology. Charles Darwin was not a biologist. Charles Darwin was a naturalist. He's a guy that studied seeds and you know, plants. And so when Charles Darwin was a young man, he started noticing the differences in seeds and plants, and how that some plants that kind of started out as one thing through crossbreeding and stuff, they became other things. You know, y'all understand that. You know, we see that. You know, corn is different today than corn was when my grandparents was raising it, because of crossbreeding and all that sort of stuff. Well, he saw that and he thought, wow, that's, I wonder if that happened to man. Now, we'll kind of back up here a little bit. Charles Darwin was a guy who called Christianity a damnable heresy. That's the way he was operating from the beginning. So, and it kind of tickles me, because people say, well, anytime you're talking about evolution, if you talk about the creationist viewpoint, you're bringing in the religious viewpoint. The truth is, it all started from a religious viewpoint of Charles Darwin. He read the Bible, concluded that his uncle and his father were going to go to hell, and said, as many people do, well, if that's the truth, I don't want anything to do with Christianity. And that's kind of how that was some of his background. It wasn't scientists. He was mad at God in the first place and kind of went down that road. That's not all it was to it, but that was a lot to do with it. So, you probably didn't want to know all that, but I just thought that was interesting. Okay. So Charles Darwin, he's a naturalist. He knows all these seeds growing differently. And he said, I'm going to go on this worldwide exploration to find out what's going on. And he gets on the ship called the HMS Beagle, B-E-A-G-L-E. And they kind of sail all over. I think they went to the South Pacific mainly, in different places. And they'll go out on these islands and find these different seeds and animals and so forth. Did it for 5 years. Came back and he wrote a book entitled The Origin of the Species. That's his book, The Origin of the Species. He wrote two books, The Origin of the Species. There was another one, I think, The Descent of Man, where he's probably his two most well-known books. The Origin of the Species is the one that we get all of our evolutionary ideas from. Even though there are other guys who are talking about the same time, he was kind of the guy that took it to the common man, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? He was kind of the popular guy. So he's written all this stuff, and he basically comes up with two basic concepts, and here they are. The first one is called natural selection. You with me? Everybody still with me? If you're getting bored, raise your hand. We'll send you outside because I'm not going to stop. So don't get bored. Natural selection. Offspring better suited to their environment will be more successfully at surviving and reproducing. And we hear about the survival of the fittest. That's natural selection, the survival of the fittest. Now, here's one that obviously didn't make it. Dinosaur didn't make it. Somewhere along the line, they died out. Now, let me say this about dinosaurs. I don't have any problem believing the existence of dinosaurs and being a Christian. I just don't. I think there's lots of evidence that something was there. I think there may be an evidence in the book of Job that's what he was describing in one of his chapters, that it was a dinosaur. I think that's possible. That is my opinion. Okay? So, if you believe in dinosaurs and you're still a Christian, don't worry. You probably will still get to go to heaven. So don't anybody freak out. If somebody says that, it doesn't mean they believe in evolution. It just means that they believe in the existence, possible existence of dinosaurs, and somewhere along the way, there was a world-changing event that they died, or that something else happened that they died. We just don't know. Okay, we just do not know. But there's nothing wrong with believing it. But natural selection says that any animal or plant or whatever, that if it does not adapt to the environment, it's either going to keep going or it's going to die. Man evolved and kept going. That's why we're still here. Dinosaurs couldn't cut it and they died. That's natural selection. Second thing of evolution is new species. A new population develops from acquiring so many new traits. Okay? Now, who can tell me, except for Larry Cole, who can tell me what this is? Can y'all see that? What is it? What kind of fly is it? Oh! Larry looked at it and he said, "That's a fruit fly." Did you say it? Alan said, "Yeah, it's a fruit fly." He said, "Well, Gary, have you lost your mind? Why are we talking about fruit flies?" Because there was this experiment. Fruit fly. These biologists got a bunch of fruit flies together and they started mating them. Now, why you want to do that, I don't know. But they mated them. And so they kept mating them, and they'd get one generation, and then they'd mate some more with another generation, another kind of fruit fly, and they'd mate some more. And all of a sudden, when they got through doing it, fruit fly A looked nothing like fruit fly X over here. Everything was changed about him. Had some few chromosomes the same. Pretty much a different fly. And so they went, is that what happened to man? And man started out in a, what do they call it, the primordial? Yeah, the suit. Started out in the suit, and he came out. He kind of crawled out on the land, and he's a little bug or something, or a slug or something. And after millions of years of all this stuff hitting on him, he kind of got a different quality, and then millions of years, something else hit on him, and he starts coming out. Pretty soon he's got legs. Pretty soon he's walking. I mean, slumped over, looks like a monkey. Pretty soon he gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then pretty soon, he's a man. I'm just telling you. That's just what it is. And pretty much, that is the way the world believes. In the 1930s, about an hour from my house, see, Cat Watson isn't the only celebrity in the group. There's a science teacher in Dayton, Tennessee. And he got up and started talking about evolution. And the school board fired him. And so he got a lawyer to come down there and defend him because he wanted his position back as a teacher. And he was teaching evolution. No one liked it. No one wanted to talk about it. So the prosecutor was a guy by the name of Williams Jennings Bryan, who was a well-known lawyer. He ran for president 3 or 4 times, didn't he? Got beat every time. But he comes down and prosecutes him. And so they have this thing called the Scopes Monkey Trial. Happened in Dayton, Tennessee. There was a play and a movie, Inherit the Wind. That's about the Scopes Monkey Trial. Inherit the Wind, that's what that's about. And so it's about, the whole Scopes Monkey Trial was to say, no, you can't teach that in school, you got to take, and it was a very religious discussion. Well, in the end, the judge ruled in favor of Scopes. Okay? And said, yes, you can teach evolution in school. And all of a sudden, evolution becomes true, and creationism becomes a theory. And for a while, they could be taught side by side, but after a while, it's like, no, it's a religious theory, no religion in school, therefore get rid of creationism. And ever since then, and that happened in 1934? Something like that. You're talking about, that's 70-something years ago that happened. Before that, that wasn't what was taught in school. So in 70 years, all that's changed, and that is evolution. That's evolutionary theory. Now, evolution. I want you to write down these two questions. This is very important. Now, I don't want you to be arrogant. I want you to be haughty. When you talk with someone who's an evolutionist, I want you, after you listen and y'all talk about it, say, I just got two questions to ask, and will you just think about them, please? You with me? Question number one. When did a non-human woman give birth to a human baby? I'm serious. It's a good question. When did that non-human woman give birth to a human baby? You remember our little thing at the beginning where you had the monkey and the monkey got bigger and so forth and so forth until finally there was an ape-like creature and then it became a man? Remember that? At some point, a non-human woman mated with a non-human man, and when that baby popped out, it was a human. You say, that sounds kind of simple. It's got tons of implications. And that question has to be answered. You know what the answer will be? I don't know. Give me some evidence. Because I'm not talking about religion here. I want some evidence that's fair for you to ask for evidence. You're supposed to give evidence all the time. It's fair to ask a person who believes in evolution to provide evidence. Now, we're talking about philosophical questions here, not scientific. So keep it on that level. Second question. At what point, they say, well, I don't know. Well, answer this one for me then. At what point did a non-human take a step, raised his foot up, and went to put the foot down, he was human. Walking along, I'm non-human, put my foot up, step, I'm human. What point did that occur? Well, that's the missing link. And it's been missing. And every time somebody comes out and says they found it, they go, oh, we found it. And they go, oh, wait a minute, well, we didn't find it. We're going to keep looking for it, though. When, at what point did a non-human take a step, raise his foot up, and when he put his foot down, he was human? That question has lots of implications to it. You say, and what? I heard a debate the other day. I was listening to a debate. And the guy said, well, it's kind of like a process of evolvement. That just gradually happens. If you believe in evolution, I don't have a problem with you saying that. That's what you ought to say. But there is a point when something that was non-human in a millionth of a second became a human. Show me the point. I don't have any evidence that happened. Then why should I believe it? I'm not saying, therefore, creationism. I'm just saying, why should I believe evolution? I'm going to go look for something else. And I think people need to answer that question. Okay? That's evolution. Oh, got to hurry. Because we've got to have big words, right? Big words. Theism, you can't see that. This is what you are. A theist believes that God is self-existent. He's infinite in all His attributes. He's created the world. He's revealed Himself to humans. And we'll talk about this some more so you don't have to write this down because we don't have time. Theism says God's self-existent. No one created Him. He's infinite in all of His attributes. He's perfect. He's created all that has existed. He's a creator. He's revealed himself to humans. He has provided supernatural revelation. That's a theist. Can I know that God exists? Three big words. Whoop. I got 5 minutes. Big word number one. Now, what I want you to do is, tomorrow morning you go to work and they're sitting around saying, what did y'all talk about yesterday? I want you to take your glasses off and go, well, you know, in our Bible class, I'm sure all of you are familiar with these terms. We talked about the ontological arguments. And you will just impress people. Jim's already told me he's going to do it. Because Jim likes big words. Jim D likes big words, so he's going to do it. The ontological argument. Write it down. This is good for you. The ontological argument. This is the old argument for the existence of God. The ontological argument says that the very idea of God implies His existence. That is, if you can think about God, and you think about God as God being perfect, which is more perfect, existence or non-existence? Existence is perfect, would be better than non-existence, right? And so if you're thinking of a perfect being, existence just has to be part of the program. And so, God exists. Now, you will dazzle your friends with that one. Unfortunately, this is promoted by a guy named Anselm about 1009. For many years, hundreds of years, this was the argument for the existence of God. If you sit around and you think about a perfect being, perfect has to include existence because existence is more perfect than non-existence. Therefore, existence must be part of the equation. Therefore, God exists. I know no one's ever, you're never going to share that with anyone. But that's kind of, it's kind of, you know, I used to sit, a bunch of us went to college. You remember you used to sit around dorm rooms on Friday night when you didn't have a date? And you talked about all these things. This is what God said around the dorm rooms in the cathedrals back in the 1000s. They didn't have dates, so they thought about this stuff. And this is the first one, the ontological argument. The second one you're more familiar with. It's called the cosmological argument. And basically it says the existence of God is a necessary condition for the existence of the world. That if you have the world out here, it had to come from somewhere. Now, not the design of the world, that's totally different. But if you got the world, it had to come from somewhere. And so we had to have what's called an uncaused cause. And you say, I don't know anything about that. Yes, you do, because you've been hearing about it in the news. Y'all remember when they put the... is it the Hadron or the Hadron Collider? Hadron Collider. The thing they said was going to cause a black hole and we're all going to die. Remember that was in the news a couple weeks ago? What they did is they created this big tube. And it went out of Germany into Switzerland or something. And they were going to shoot a proton out of one side. These physicists were a proton on the other side. They're supposed to meet over here in the middle and hit each other and cause a mini explosion. People said, oh, that's going to create a black hole. We're all going to be sucked through. We're all going to die. And they did it and nothing happened. In fact, I think the protons missed the first time. And they say that's called, what's that called? The Big Bang. Everybody's heard of the Big Bang Theory, right? That's the Big Bang Theory. It says these protons hit and whoop, world up. And that's how the world was created. Now you say, well, how in the world do I answer that? Ask this question. Just think. Where did the protons come from? Where did the gas and the mass and the rain and the water, rather, and the minerals, when they all met out of space, blew up and created the world, where'd they come from? Oh, well, they came from this corner of the universe. Good. Where'd that come from? Well, some scientists say now, get this, the universe is eternal. Really? And when someone says the universe is eternal, I'm going to say, so what you're saying now is you don't want to observe, so we're going to just throw away the second law of dynamics, which is one of the main laws of physics, which something's created, everything is created, eventually evolves down. You're saying that's not true anymore. Well, I don't want to say that. Explain it to me, Lucy. Right? Explain it to me. You say it started, uncaused cause, it had to start somewhere. Last one, and this one we'll spend, we're going to see video on, so you'll like this one. The teleological argument. The teleological argument. So we got ontological, cosmological. Jim, you impressed yet? One more. Getting there. One more. The teleological argument. And this is one that we all know. This is the argument from design. William Paley was a Christian philosopher. And he came up with this idea. You got a watch on the ground, like mine. Got these little intricacies on it. If I find that laying on the ground, I'm walking through the park one day, and I see this watch on the ground, and I pick it up, I don't think, wow, millions and billions of years, dirt, rocks, grime, water, man stepping on it, dinosaurs scraping it. Wow, look what happened. A Rolex. That's so stinking cool. You pick it up and you go, I wonder who made this? Right? Anything intricate, we think, I wonder who made that. That's the teleological argument. The facts of order and indication of design and nature prove the existence of God. If you've got a design, which you do with the world, you've got to have a designer. Okay? And that's called the teleological argument. Now, we're going to see either next week or the week after that, we've got a big video presentation. We'll talk about the design argument. So this is one where we'll kind of camp out. So just remember, because this is important, the cosmological argument has to do with what? Right, the Big Bang, the world, where did it all come from? The teleological argument has to do with the design of the world. What we look like, what the plants, birds, all that stuff looks like. That's the design of the world, and that's a little bit different. The ontological argument, we're never going to talk about anymore. Okay? All right. Come on. So next week, we'll talk about design. If we can't talk about that, we're going to talk about something else.